From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
The history and pictures of Western South Dakota run deep. Fred Farrar captured the Black Hills from the turn of the century through the Depression of the 1930s. As a young boy, Fred's mother read him The Last of the Mohicans, which ended up being a major influence on him when it came to nature and Native American culture. For this week's Images of the Past, we learn more about this pioneer. Enjoy.
Mark Slocum is Executive Director of the Minnelusa Historical Association and Pioneer Collection in Rapid City. Mark, thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about Fred Farrar. Tell us a little bit about who he was and the work that is his legacy today.
All right. Well, we actually got to focus on Fred Farrar for a full Images of the Past last time, but I wanted to include him on our entirety of our collection just because it's so important. His collection makes up about 2,500 photographs, and they feature images of cowboys, Rapid City history, pioneers, Native Americans, and the Black Hills from about the turn of the century to the Great Depression. So a really important time in our local history. All captured through his lens. So I included a couple new images on this one, including, I hope you got to see the camel.
Yes, the camel. I was going to ask you about the camels.
That's my favorite. So he would often take images, you know, just of people in everyday life, but all of the spectacular events that would happen in Rapid City, including parades, circuses, state fairs, anything you can imagine. And in this particular image, I believe this is maybe an Elks parade, and they would bring in all kinds of things. I've seen elephants in some of these collections, but in this particular is camels advertising local businesses.
that's the fun part, is the camels are walking with these banners draped over their humps and along their flanks, just telling you where you should shop.
Exactly.
down the dirt. Now, I want to talk about this, and I want to talk about the photo collection, but also these historic photos are so fascinating to look at now as we are living through a time that everybody recognizes as historic, where sometimes we live through times and we don't really think we forget about making our own history. This is a time where everybody is tuned in to the fact that we're living history and we're documenting it. When you look at these historic photos in your collection from Fred Farrar and others, what are some of the things that stand out to you as the details that you're just so glad were captured at that time?
Well, you know, even to bring it back to today, Fred would even take photos of natural disasters, of fires, of floods. We all remember the 1972 flood here in Rapid City in the Black Hills, but that wasn't the very first flood to really impact our area. So, you know, on our website where a lot of these images are available, one of the quick searches you can do is just floods. And it reminds you that history does repeat itself sometimes. And we've gone through these natural disasters before. You can think about the 1919 flood. The flu epidemics, the Spanish flu, and what we're going through today. So it's a really a good way to reflect on what's happening now and in the past.
Yeah, there's a picture here of the School of Mines basketball team. And as soon as I saw that photo, my grandmother played basketball in Lake Park, Iowa, and she was like 5 foot I mean, if she was more than 5 foot, I don't know, but maybe 5 foot one. And I remember her telling the story, and she would always say, I played basketball in the black bloomers, and I would just love to have a picture of my grandmother on the basketball team at 5 foot one wearing black bloomers, because we get to see how so much has changed, how athletics has changed, how the environment has changed, how the clothes that we wear changed, how we see the world is different. This collection, you can view it online, right? Tell us a little bit about how to access for the regular public some of these photos, because so many of us are not walking into cultural organizations right now to see what's in the exhibition. We're searching things out online. That's an opportunity here.
Exactly, yeah. I'm excited to tell you about that as well. Just recently, we were able to upload all approximately 10,000 images to our Past Perfect site, which is connected to our Minnelusa.org website. And if you visit one of the links that I provided on the article, or else you can also go to Minnelusa.org and search research, view our digital archives. And there are several ways to search through the archives once you get there. I've set up a few quick searches, such as the Fred Farrar collection, the Carl Leedy collection, the Stratable flights, and the 1972 flood and other floods. You can, if you're thinking you want to find pictures of buffalo, you can go in into an advanced search or a keyword search and do that, or else just click random images and get lost down the rabbit hole of this collection and be able to sit there for hours.
What a gift. Tell us a little bit about Carl Leedy. He's a personality for sure.
Yeah, Carl Leedy is a personality. Well, he was a pretty important historian and member of the Minnelusa Historical Association. He was one of the founders of the collection. And back in 1956, when they were building a museum in Halley Park, all of the members of the association brought in their own collections, their own attics, to create this museum. And Carl Leedy has quite the photo collection, object collection, as well as we have a whole wall full of scrapbooks, obituaries, articles he's written. And he is a pretty interesting character. He's written two books, Golden Days in the Black Hills and Black Hills Pioneer Stories. A lot of those stories are colorful. He's been known to be a little exaggerative, if that's a word. In his writings, but they're all entertaining and tell really, really cool stories about the Black Hills.
When we have some of these conversations today, we have them in the context with the awareness of conflict and massacre and the full impact of history. When you look back to people like Fred Farrar or Carl Leedy or some of those early photographs, did they have that awareness too? Can you tell? Can you extrapolate it all from their images? Or are they part of this, they're just all into what the Wild West is and they're not really seeing the fuller picture? I'm always curious about that.
You know, I feel like Fred Farrar really, because Carl was a collector of stories and photos. His stories, I think, would probably give a little bit of his own personality and take on the current situation that he's, or the historical story he was, you know, conveying to someone. Fred Farrar, on the other hand, he was the full-on photographer. His studio was outside in the Black Hills. So he was covering all of those events. And, you know, he really did have to put himself in there. And was he taking just photos that looked nice? Or was he trying to say something? That's for us to decide as we look through them, I think.
Now, throughout this pandemic, we've been asking a few of our trusted friends five essential questions about life during the pandemic. This Earth Day, we invited David O'Hara to return to In the Moment. He is a director of sustainability at Augustana University and professor of philosophy, classics, and environmental studies.
Dr. O'Hara, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. It's great to be here.
Let's start with some of the things that you have learned that you find essential during this time of crisis, those things that, you know, are so important to you that you've figured out ways to keep doing them, even though it's not the normal way of doing things.
Asking a philosophy professor what's essential is always a tricky question, but I'll avoid the technical language of my discipline, and I'll say really simply, I miss my students. I miss them constantly every day, and the chances that I get to see them on Zoom or Skype or talk with them, you know, I'm using every bit of technology that I can to stay in touch with them. You know this. In my office, I've got probably 50 different kinds of tea, and I've got a lazy boy for my students. I love it when they stop by, the office doors open, they pour themselves a cup of tea, and they sit down, not because they want to talk about a grade or something, although that's fine too, but just those unscheduled, impromptu conversations. I really miss that.
Yeah.
So what I've been doing, reaching out to them, writing them emails. Just yesterday, I sent a whole bunch of handwritten letters out to students and even and to alumni as well. It takes more time, but totally worth it.
You know, when I was a college student and my daughter's a college student now, I think none of us ever really thought that our professors would miss us. And I have seen consistently from, so I've reminded my daughter that several times. I'm like, you know, they miss you, right? And it's been hard for her to get her mind around. I mean, she thinks about how she feels about them, but that the student is so important in the student-professor relationship can go overlooked because we, how we sort of elevate professors in our imagination, maybe. So that has been a really wonderful thing for me to learn and sort of see I would say it's wonderful to see the grief on professors, but to see the expression of of connection that I've seen so much of.
I remember when I was a college student thinking that my professor's offices were these sacred spaces where if I went in there, you know, I'm surrounded by these dusty old books and somebody with gray hair and a tweed jacket. And I thought, oh, I'm interrupting this, you know,
right.
This great sage. Yeah. And I don't want that to be the case. I mean, I could be doing other kinds of jobs. I could be making a lot more money somewhere else. But the time with the students is, that's gold to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought my professors were just kind of tolerating me. Maybe they were.
I sometimes wondered that about myself, too.
Right. Yeah. All right. So, and one of the things I just love asking people right now is that we all have the same big problems right now. And what's your biggest small problem? Because there were things that we talked about before that were going on in our lives that we don't mention anymore because it seems so ridiculous to say it's a problem when we're living in a pandemic and an economic crisis. What's your biggest small problem right now?
Yeah. You know, you told me you were going to ask this question and I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I don't know if I've got a good answer. I feel like I've got generic answers. Like, the biggest thing that's come to mind is that the time we're in right now reminds me of how different the urgent is from the truly important. Mm. And, you know, I think prior to this virus hitting us, a lot of my days were filled with urgent things. You know, you get that email, you get a call, you're thinking about your taxes, and thankfully taxes and the tax they got put off because I was behind. You know, all the little things that they feel like, oh, you got to do this right now. And it turns out you don't have to do this right now. And I know this will sound like a funny answer, but even money felt urgent and feels less urgent right now. And I don't say that as somebody who's rich. I'm not. But I say that as somebody who's aware of just how fragile so many of my neighbors are right now.
Yeah.
And it feels like, so the money's still important, but it's less about my money and more about our money. Mm-hmm. There's this passage in, I think it's in The Grapes of Wrath, where Steinbeck says, there's two ways of formulating a problem. You could imagine one person who's got some bread and one person who's got none. And then you got a hungry person. Or you can imagine one person who's got bread and one person who's got none, and you can imagine two people who have some bread. And I like that second way of formulating it. And he says, you know, in the Dust Bowl, that was that second one that often came up for people when we realized we get, lots of us are suffering, and that means that the little bit that we have, we can share. And those little things that we were clinging to that seemed so important are a lot less important unless they're shared. It's like that idea that bread tastes better when it's broken with other people. I don't know if that's a good answer to your question, but that's what comes to mind anyway.
And do you think that as we watch, you know, the virus beginning in one way, and then really the greatest impact is on people without means, and we're sort of living that out and seeing it happen. Not that the virus discriminates based on wealth, but we've seen people be able to retreat into their homes and some people not be able mm-hmm. to do that. It gives us a really uncomfortable awareness of how the world around us is structured that maybe we didn't notice before. I hope
that's right.
We're paying attention to that. I hope we're paying attention to, I mean, everything from a nursing home to a prison to where are the people at the highest risk. Maybe we didn't spend a lot of time thinking about that before and how we expect people to live. I don't know.
Yeah.
What's bringing you?
Yeah, my colleague, Craig Spencer, is a biology professor at Augie. He stopped by his mom's retirement home a couple of weeks back when there was still snow on the ground and built a snowman outside of her window because he couldn't go in to see her.
Wow.
And for me, that was sort of iconic of what's going on all over the city and all over our country as well, just feeling like we can't be with the people who often most need us and whom we most need.
Yeah. I was talking to my mother early on in this, and we were saying so many people stockpiled things, but did we stockpile people? Did we think about who we were going to be quarantined with, or did we sort of casually land in the places that we, you know, that we retreated to quickly without really considering how we would get to some of the people that were more important than the toilet paper?
Yeah. My wife, as you know, is a pastor here in town, the Church of the Good Shepherd over on 33rd. She's been live streaming services. So, you know, it's an empty building other than her and me. I'm there with the camera and sometimes one or two other people to help out, all of us keeping great distance from one another. Since I'm on the camera, I see how many people are logging into the Facebook Live broadcasts. And it's amazing to me, you know, these are people who could say, ah, well, there's a virus, I'm just going to skip church. But the numbers have actually been going up. I think we have more attendance on Facebook Live than we have sometimes in the service itself. I think because people are, just as you say, they value those relationships. And when they can't be with one another physically, they'll take whatever they can.
Yeah. What brings you joy right now? What feeds your soul and keeps you going even when the news is bleak?
Oh, so many things. One of them is, just as you were hinting at before, seeing people's generosity. I had a couple of students from reservations, and so their families are, as with the case of so many students who live on reservations, not particularly financially wealthy. And some of them, you know, having to return home and can't be on campus, they don't have access to some of the technology we have on campus. And I know that there are a number of folks in the community who have just stepped up and bought them technology. Mm-hmm. You know, just like, you know, mailing a printer off to somebody that they don't know living on Rosebud. And I hear about that and I go, thanks be to God. That is so, so generous when one person who doesn't know another person, they just hear about a need and they just step in and do it. For me, being outside, gardening, like I said, seeing my students' faces online, time with my wife, these things are these are giving me great joy. And I'm teaching a class on liturgy right now. The class, I thought the class would be fun to teach. I knew it would be fun to teach because the class is about those rhythms and patterns and cadences of our lives that sustain us. I had no idea going into teaching this semester that those cadences were going to be disrupted and to see just how relevant a class on liturgy would be. But it turned out to be really, relevant and really helpful, and it's giving me joy to be able to teach about these things to students right now.
I watched your Facebook video about about liturgies, and I took 2 pages of notes, David. and this idea of what are the things that you want to preserve, finding patterns when patterns have been taken away from you, and then thinking about what are these essential things to me right now. And that can be really hard in a crisis because some patterns are being forced on us, and others have been taken away. But I'm hoping in our remaining minute or so, we could talk more about that, because I wanted for people who didn't get to see that, you use the something that you do every day, something that you do every year, these things that you're pulling from some of the pillars of Islam and saying this might not be your tradition, but when we talk about liturgy, these are some things that Muslims consider are essential throughout a lifetime. Go over those for, could you repeat that for listeners who haven't been able to see that online?
Sure, and you can feel free to post a link later to the YouTube video. But what I talked about is the 5 pillars of Islam. So we study this in middle school or in high school, and we're learning about the generic ideas. But the 5 pillars of Islam are, the way I teach them, it's something that you do every day, prayer, something that you do every year. And in the case of Islam, Ramadan, but we could think of Lent or Easter or Christmas in my tradition. Something that you do every lifetime. In the case of Islam, this is making pilgrimage or making Hajj. Something that you do at every opportunity, and that is caring for the needy, giving alms to the poor. And something that you do at every moment, and that is remembering the values that you have, the creed that you have, and the things that sustain you. And you can think about all 5 of those pillars in terms of a cadence throughout life. And they're parallels of those in Christianity as well. I mean, here we are, we're in Orthodox Easter, and Western Easter has just ended. This is a time when we've come out of this long period of fasting and entered into a period of feasting. And the coronavirus makes it feel like this can't be a time of feasting. But if we don't set aside intentional times for feasting, even if it's that shared piece of bread, that Dust Bowl bread that Steinbeck wrote about, that intentional feasting together sustains us.
On March 27th, Rapid City enacted an ordinance that called for the closure of most city businesses to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus and help buy time for Avera healthcare workers to prepare for a surge of COVID-19 cases. It was one of the earliest and toughest set of restrictions in the state. Now, Kevin Wooster lives out in Rapid City, and he writes a blog, on the other hand, for SDPB. He joined Lori for a discussion about, well, what's going on from the West River perspective? Let's take a listen.
Kevin, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's great to be back. And every day you get up and watch for the governor's briefing, and you expect 12 new cases in Pennington County, or 18 new cases in Lawrence County, or 30 new cases. And most days in Pennington County, you get none. And some days you get 1, and now it's up to, what, 11? Is that what it was? I haven't seen today.
11 confirmed, 8 people have fully recovered, and with the 1 person who died early on, that would mean, if my math is correct, that there's 1 active case right now. Yesterday's negative test was at 355. Today is 367. So that also tells you that, 11 tests came back yesterday for Pennington County, which is not a large number of tests.
No, it's not a large number of tests. And you can wonder, is testing a part of it? The focus over east, that they're putting so much emphasis on the hot spot and those smaller surge areas that we've had. Is the isolation out here a factor? Is the fact that I think the city was really proactive in a lot of ways, and working on their own here, and then plus the closure of the schools and the state tournaments and all that kind of stuff. And we, you know, we don't have a packing plant anymore here. We used to have one in the middle of town. And who knows if we had one, if something had happened there, because it can go so fast within a closed environment like that. But what we wait for, I think most of us, you know, it's almost like a storm that's been predicted that, you know, you keep looking at the western horizon and thinking, oh, something's going to come up over the ridge here and it's just going to drench us. And it doesn't. And so the question that I have is, and I think I touched that on the blog, it seems to me like when we lost a member of our community right away, and he wasn't here apparently when he contracted the virus, but lost that first death in South Dakota was our person from Pennington County. And I think that was a shock to people, and I think there was a reaction there, a noticeable reaction. And it seems like that is now faded a little bit in some areas. It almost comes and goes. I go to one spot and everybody's wearing gloves. Go back 2 weeks later and half of them are wearing gloves or none of them are. And that's kind of what I touched on here in this column too.
Yeah. And I'm wondering about tourist season and the sunshine and so much of the Black Hills economy being visitor based. What happens? Is the storm on the horizon? A very nice, you know, spring and summer day, and people from all over the country who have been watching the news and have been told again and again that Governor Kristi Noem did not shut down South Dakota. They might not realize the nuances of that, but some of the reporting has been very broad-based about her refusal to issue a statewide shutdown order. They might not even know that the restaurants in Rapid City are currently not open. What happens in the days ahead, do you think?
Yeah, and on that, I like to say that I think some of the reporting, especially at the national level, has not been very fair in that regard. That you know, there's it was never explained. It was insinuated that we had this broad order that she didn't impose, and that because of that, we had a blow up at Smithfield. It wasn't said in those words, but I think the tone of the stories and the headlines you saw implied that. And there's no indication that's true, that it would have made any difference to the Smithfield infection. It may have slowed the spread outside the plant. I don't know if it would have. But I think the reporting on that, especially from the national crews, has been incomplete and unfair in a lot of ways. And because it didn't also touch on the fact of how low the rates are across South Dakota. It focused on this one hot spot as if, well, see, we told you, that's what happened. And I've been disappointed in my profession, at least parts of it in that, I think. The question that you raise and I raise, what comes next is, you know, one that Sam Hurst and I, my friend Sam was a journalist and is my age group. And that I talk about us walking appropriately 12 feet apart or whatever on the boulevard the other day, talking about this situation and what does come next. You know, is there a surge out there waiting? We, you know, when we had a bank that had a New York person in training and that person left with the disease and later tested positive for it, I think everybody thought, here we go. Then when we had a healthcare worker with it, I think everybody thought, here we go. And then up in the hills, some casino workers with it. And why hasn't it taken off? And that's what we were talking about today. And what comes next? And is there a danger that will let up a little bit and will help it take off? That's certainly a concern that I have.
Right. And it seems like an easy answer. Like, yes, if we let up. The science seems to be pretty clear that letting up can cause further outbreaks. And we were just talking, I don't know if you listened to Randy Bury, who's president of the Good Sam Society, and he talked about this Good Samaritan Sioux Falls village. And when they had their first cases, they tested everybody. And even in a nursing home and long-term care facility, they found that some of the senior citizens were positive and had no symptoms. So even a person who's at very high risk could be a carrier and have no symptoms of this.
Yeah.
367 tests is not really indicative of how far this has spread in the state or in the Black, in Pennington County specifically. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, there's cases out here because I have somebody in my extended family that certainly had the symptoms that fit, but was young and not in distress and didn't get a test at that time. Another member of the family had maybe even lesser symptoms, but had been recently out of state to one of the states they worried about, got a test, it was negative. So I don't, you know, did we miss one in the family that had it and others didn't get infected as far as we know? Or are there others carrying that we don't even know? And that's why every day we look at that horizon and say, has something been building up in there and it's just going to explode over and hit us, you know, hard? And that's why I think there's a lot of talk about the discussion at the city level here about very slowly and carefully reopening. As Mayor Allender says, the way they've restricted it, a lot of the restaurants, for example, don't even want to try and reopen under those restrictions because they can't get enough people into the restaurant to be worth staffing it and, you know, ordering right. everything. So I don't know where we're going with that, but I do feel like Allender and the city council have really worked hard to be responsible on this, and I know they take a lot of heat over it. And the big question you raised, Sam Hurst raised on his Facebook page, what about the tourist season? What is our plan at the state level? And so far, I'm not aware that there is one specifically. Does Sturgis get to decide if they have a rally, or does the state have to decide that somehow? Big issues coming up, and they're not that far away.
Right. Meanwhile, you have loved ones who are working in that emergency room in another city. Tell us a little bit about sort of feeling that relaxed, I'm here, I'm fishing, and then the phone call comes, and it's what you don't want to hear.
Yeah, and it's what I knew, you know, that you try and deny. There's a certain level of compartmentalization and denial, you know, especially if you've got a son and a daughter-in-law in a major city with in a down in their city hospital, emergency room doctors, and it's been fairly quiet. You know, this is Minnesota, and the governor's been very aggressive, and the people have been very, you know, aggressive about these things, and I think it's had an effect. It's been fairly quiet in ENR, but it's picking up. So, you know, that's always rests on your shoulders, and you kind of set it aside and do what I do, and we're lucky to live where we are out here where I can get away by myself and forget everything. And then you send a text while you're having your lunch along the lake to your son and say, hey, how's it going? Just checking in. And the text is very brief, and it comes back and says, well, I just intubated a COVID patient. Too busy to talk much more than that. And then you know it all along, but you realize I'm fishing. My son's trying to save somebody's life. And that's going on all over the country, that disconnect. And it's a reminder, you know. Of course, it's the dad. You say, be careful. Like, oh, really? You don't think he would know to be careful? And he comes back and says, jokes first, and then gets serious and says, no, double goggles, double gloves, the gown, you know, the double face masks, everything. Yeah, we take it when we intubate. Obviously, that's a crucial moment for infection for healthcare workers, one of them. And that changes the way you spend the rest of your afternoon fishing, just because it's a reminder of the reality that we set aside from time to time, which is it's here and it's real and it's dangerous and it's killing some people and not killing others, as you say, that are just walking around but maybe spreading it. We've got to continue to take it really seriously.
Yeah. On that note, this news just in from Seth Tupper, 2 South Dakota racetracks will not let fans in to see races this weekend. Park Jefferson International Speedway and the New Raceway Park say they will still hold races. However, spectators will not be able to watch the events in person at the racetracks near North Sioux City. Video feeds of the races will be available instead. The track had planned to sell hundreds of tickets for the Saturday and Sunday events, but both tracks came under pressure from the public and elected officials because of fears about fans spreading the coronavirus. Those tracks neighbor each other in the southeast corner of the state. So that news just in. Kevin Wooster, thank you so much for being here today. We'll be thinking about your loved ones and in the emergency room as we sometimes can forget what's happening behind the scenes to keep people safe and save lives. We appreciate your time today.
And all those people are loved ones to somebody. So,
yeah.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Helene Cardona. Cardona was born in Paris, France, to a Spanish father and Greek mother. She was raised in several cities around Europe. She became interested in writing at a young age. In fact, she started writing poetry when she was 10. After high school, she attended the Sorbonne in Paris, where she received her BA in Spanish and English. She then studied for an MA in American literature, also at the Sorbonne, which she received a few years later. Cardona has long been interested and fascinated by language, by words. So it comes as no surprise that she continued her education at the University of Cambridge, where she studied English philology. She then studied Spanish at the University of Santander in Spain, as well as German at the Goethe Institute in Bremen. Cardona is fluent in English, French, Spanish, German, Greek, and Italian. Not surprisingly, her poetry shifts between languages, and she is a talented translator who has worked for the Canadian Embassy in Paris. In regards to writing in language, she had this to say in a recent interview. "I write as a form of self-expression, fulfillment, transcendence, and healing to transmute pain and experience into beauty. Translation is necessary to know oneself, to know where one comes from. Every language is a key into the psyche of a people. When you understand other cultures, you don't fear the other." Her books include Dreaming My Animal Selves, The Astonished Universal, Life in Suspension, and also a number of books that she has translated, including Burnham Wood, which is a poetry collection by her Spanish father. Cardona has won a Hemingway Grant, the Best Bilingual Poetry Book Award, the International Book Award in Poetry, the Pinnacle Award, and many others. When not writing, Cardona is an actress, and it's possible that you've seen her in Chocolat, The Romanoffs, World War Z, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Muppets Most Wanted, Jurassic Park, and the TV show Star Trek Discovery. She has taught at Hamilton College and Loyola Marymount College. She lives in Santa Monica, California. Today's poem is The Sexiest Flower. I don't think this poem needs much of an introduction. It blossoms up for us and reveals itself without a lot of need for explanation. There is one word, however, that might be new to some listeners. That word is Cythera. It's another word for Aphrodite, the goddess of love, beauty, and passion. In Cardona's book, Dreaming My Animal Selves, she has the original French version of the poem on one page, and her English translation of it is on the next page. I thought it might be nice to hear both linguistic versions of this poem, so I've asked my colleague and friend, Dr. Scott Fish, to read the French for us. He teaches French at Augustana University, and he has served as the national president for the Pi Delta Phi, that is, the National French Honor Society. Scott, welcome and thanks so much for reading this poem for us.
Thank you, Patrick, for inviting me. This poem, The Sexiest Flower by Hélène Cardona in French, is La fleur la plus séduisante. Les orchidées séduisent, signes sensuels à figure humaine, leur bouche primale captive, cocon fantôme, luisant au clair de lune. Animaux subliminaux, dont l'élégance et la passion du théâtre se saturent de perfection. Sanguines ou virginales, elles prennent 4 ans à fleurir et jeter leur sort. Leurs paupières iris caressent secrets de tentacules orange, langues pourpres, robes d'or ruisselantes de joyaux, lèvres succulentes qui cautérisent nos désirs immortels. Leur audace virtuose et regard baissé nous ensorcellent et nous convoque à citer.
This is The Sexiest Flower, the English version. Orchids seduce, sultry swans shaped like us, their primal mouths entice, ghost cocoons aglow in moonlight, subliminal animals whose elegance and passion for the theater fixate on perfection. Sanguine or virginal, they take 4 years to flower and cast their spell. Their iris lids caress secrets of orange tentacles, purple tongues, gold robes dripping jewels, luscious lips that cauterize our desires in their everness. Their bold mastery and downward glances bewitch and summon us to Cythera.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.